surgery with Dr. Robert Allington on 13 November 2001. The interviewers are Arnold Thackeray and John Van Ness. And Dr. Allington, perhaps you could begin by just talking a little bit about your family background.
Okay, well, I will do that, and I had to do some research on dates on this, which I cannot remember right now, and I asked Susan to bring them in here, but she must have misunderstood. If you'll excuse me for a few minutes, I'll go pick them up.
Should I go out?
Yeah.
Okay.
I hadn't realized that this was supposed to be this inclusive. Somehow I had the idea that it was supposed to be more about the company than...
We'll get to that.
Well, yeah. So this, in reviewing the stuff this weekend, I saw my mistakes. I've been rapidly trying to scribble things down that have to do with personal stuff and family history. Hence the reason that she doesn't have it done yet. My father and mother are both born in Nebraska, both in 1912. And my father was born in a ranch north of Sunol, Nebraska, which is a small population 60 town about 11 miles east of Sydney, Nebraska, which is the local metropolis, about 5,000 inhabitants. It's except for bottom land along the principal creek through the Blaze Lodgepole Creek, it's pretty arid and dry and grassland. My father wasn't born. That's the trouble with not having this stuff in front of you. My father was raised there. He was born in Lodgepole, Nebraska.
Lodgepole.
Yeah. In a stone house, which is still there. And I've seen it. And then where did this living in a stone house in a creek in Lodgepole, Nebraska come from? Well, to explain this, I'll go back to my grandfather, who was a man I greatly admired. And his name is Bert Allington. And he was the son of John Allington, who was, and he was born in Brownville, Nebraska, I believe in 1878. I can check that with material yesterday. And he and his father didn't get along very well. His father was a ne'er-do-well and made most of his living on gambling, both with cards and on speculative deals and things like this. And apparently wasn't very good at it, because in 1892, I think it was 14, they left Brownville from California in a wagon. I don't know if it was a covered wagon or not, I suppose it was. And they didn't have enough money to move themselves out there by railroad. Mm-hmm. And they followed the UP Railroad. They got to Sydney, which was out in western Nebraska, and so-called Panhandle. And he jumped out of a wagon and hid in the town. And they took a cursory look for him and then got back in the wagon and went on to California. Like this 14-year-old kid in Florida, which was probably the toughest town in Nebraska, the tough railroad town, still a tough town. And there were no social services in 1892. So he did this as a 14-year-old, but he got the job as a so-called ox skinner. That doesn't mean it slaughters oxen. That means that he is setting up a freight wagon and either two or four things, oxen and a whip, and he follows it. He'd carry merchandise in the railhead in Sydney with ammunition, guns, food, blasting powder, so on, to the gold mines in the Black Hills. Now, at this time, the gold miners had broken an Indian treaty to be in the Black Hills, and this he'd be by himself, drive, sometimes with a group, sometimes with himself, driving his ox wagon, which is incredibly slow, you know, at top speed, about 2 miles an hour. And there's always a danger he'd get killed by the Indians, but he never did, obviously. Or I wouldn't be here. And he would bring this stuff to the back Black Hills, and then bring gold and stuff back to the railroad, which was like he didn't get robbed. And he was tough. I mean, he was a big guy. He carried personal weapons with him. And he was a tough kid. And,
oh, yeah, that's amazing.
Yeah, and he finally decided there wasn't any much future in driving driving freight wagons, and he got a job as a miner in one of these Bradley Lake mines, which was long before there was anything like mine safety. And there was a foreman and two or three workers. The foreman was a drunk, and he'd been working there for a year or so, and it was winter, and the shaft went down, I don't know how far into the ground, not far, probably 50 feet, 100 feet, and then there was a room at the bottom of the shaft where they kept tools and lanterns and stuff like that, dynamite, and it was cold in this mine because it was a shallow mine. There was this big shaft, and they'd tunnel away from it. Wasn't very long, and so they had drilled some holes on a particular, and it was particularly cold the next day when they went to set the charges. And the charges wouldn't go off because it was too cold for them to detonate. The caps would go in and go fizzle like that. The dynamite would fizzle instead of the detonating. And the foreman knew what to do. He said, "Well, that dynamite's cold." And we're going to do about that. Well, heat it up. And there was a pot-bellied stove. There's a pot-bellied stove in this room at the base of the shaft, and they could make lunch on it. He took their dynamite, several sticks of dynamite, whatever was needed to put in the holes, put them on a frying pan, put them on the stove, and then all of them got absorbed in the card game.
Oh, no.
And before the card game was over, the whole mess on the stove blew up. And there were pieces of cast iron all around the place, and it just happened that this room was kind of highly niched, and the niches were such that none of the direct blast hit these guys. They had some slow velocity pieces of cast iron plinking under the bounced off the dirt walls, you know. The blast hurt their ears, all this stuff. And it was just luck, you know, that none of them had gone out to get a drink of water or pee or anything like that. And so he quit as a gold miner. Let's see if I got some dates here. 1898, he opened a store, a mining camp, general store, for dynamite and general supplies. He married Cherry Wallace. It wasn't a very successful operation, so they dropped it and moved to Lisco, Nebraska, which is a little town on North Platte River in the wilderness, on what was called a tree claim. It was like a of Abraham Lincoln's claims, except that it was 320 acres instead of 160 acres, but in addition to building a house on it and staying there for 5 years, you had to plant so much of it in trees, because this whole area was treeless and desert-like. And it was, so he did this, improved up on it, and sold it. And in 1905, he moved to Lodgepole, Nebraska, where my father was born in 1912. And he started farming and ranching in Lodgepole. And he made enough money to buy some ranch land north of the town of Sunol, which is between Lodgepole and Sydney, and built a very nice craftsman-style house, and went into the ranching business. And in 1941, I met him for the first time. It was very dramatic. We were in the kitchen, and it was supper time. And of course, everybody was waiting for this guy because he was a grand man. And you know, there was a bunch of banging around out there in the dirt room where you scrape most of the dirt off. He comes in there, and he was an incredible sight. He was wearing cowboy denims and leather riding boots, and covered with dust. He got most of all the dust off. You could hear him slashing the dust, knocking the dust off himself in the murder room. But he's still pretty dusty. And his he had a red bandana around his neck and a cowboy hat. And none of all this was real. And you could see his face. You could see that he'd been working with a bunch of cattle that were kicking up a lot of dust, because his face, from his eyes on down, was more or less clean when he pulled the bandana up. And he had this raccoon effect around his eyes. He would put this under his hat, and around his eyes it went around like that, and then two flashing, lively eyes there in this dark band. And he stomped around, spoke with a hearty voice, and everybody, yes sir, yes sir, you know. And he was respected, and that was something. And it was the first time I saw that this was better than Hopalong Cassidy. Much better.
Yeah.
And anyway, that was a really high point. And 1957, he retired, moved to Lincoln, had to have stomach, because he had to have stomach surgery due to chewing too much snooze all his life. And he didn't have stomach cancer, but it was all pretty much burnt up from the stuff that he'd swallowed. And so I was with him for for almost a year, and he told me a lot of stories about his life and taught me how to play chess, and that was quite a time. And he went back to Sunol in 1958 to take care of his wife who had terminal Parkinson's disease, and he died in 1961 on the ranch. And let's see, my father was born in 1912 in Lodgepole, graduate of Sunol High School, class of 3, 1929. Here at the University of Nebraska, now University of Nebraska Lincoln, or UNL, in 1929, he worked through school. Fortunately, he started as a dishwasher in the plant pathology department. It's the first time he became involved in the scientific atmosphere. Then he was mentored by Dr. Robert, kind of gross here, that's wrong, Dr. Robert Goss, G-O-S-S. He was a department head, got his bachelor's in 1933. Married my mother, Norma Evelyn Peterson, in 1933. Master's degree in plant path, University of Nebraska, 34. entered grad school of the University of Wisconsin in 1934. Plant pathology, got a PhD in plant pathology in 1938, continued in the department until 42. In 1938, my brother was born, and I was born in 35. In early 1942, he took a position as the soybean disease researcher at the USDA lab at the University of Illinois. And in January 48, he accepted an associate professorship in plant pathology at UNL Lincoln. His old mentor, Dr. Goss, was still the department of the chairman of the department at that time. He became full professor and head in chairman in 1949. His job was research and administration, very little teaching. He taught one course every other semester. And 1954, he partially self-built a new house in Lincoln. Brother John and I helped on the work. In the 1960s, he invented a method for control of virus X disease in potatoes, which greatly stunts the size of the tumors. And his idea or process or whatever was like this. He'd take the growing tips off of potato plants and like leaves, and the end of the area that where the initial growth takes place, the leading area for the growth, where the growth is at the highest velocity, is at the so-called meristem tip. And I only have a vague idea what that is, since I'm not a botanist. And up until this time, it wasn't called virus X because they thought it was a genetic defect. It was so closely involved with the genetic DNA of the plant. He first discovered that it was a virus, and then second, he wondered if the virus, as it propagated in the growing plant, could propagate as fast as the plant could grow if you provided optimum efficiency with the plant growth. So he started growing these meristem tips in whatever you call it, high potency or whatever, tissue culture, so that they grow exceeding fast. And sure enough, if you snip off the tippity tip ends of these things and then regrow those in another tissue culture, they'd be virus free. Mm-hmm. And he developed methods that could be used so that local potato organizations that have certified potatoes just for size and so forth could have a little part-time laboratory where they could hire a housewife to run a simplified version of this test. It was an antibody test. He hired somebody to become superintendent of a rabbit herd in the basement of the plant industry building, and produced continuing antibodies to virus X, and then they used an immunoassay to determine whether the plant was infected. If the plant was infected, they wouldn't sell the plants. Potatoes are propagated commercially by cutting up the tubers and then planting these tubers. And so they use only virus-free tubers, and then the tubers would be carefully washed with formaldehyde and kept in sterile conditions till they planted them, and it worked. Mm-hmm. And then 1967, in another winter, the Republic of Columbia, which was a famine-struck place at the time, and if they had a Republic's invitation to work on virus X, or work on this potato disease, and he led a program that brought virus X under control in Columbia, and for a while at least, solved their food problem.
Was that a company? How was the antibody distributor, or was this a state service?
It was a state service, and they wound up which annoyed my father, but he didn't normally in a very deep level, because he cooperated in this. In fact, he'd go to other states. I remember accompanying him to Alabama once to show him how down there how to do this, and he was very cooperative with him. The idea really was not to improve the world's food production at the cost of the Mayor of Nebraska taxpayer. It was just to improve the world's food production, period. And but he knew the difference, and it sometimes it bothered him about where his funding came from. Most of it came from the Nebraska Potato Association in the state, and some of it from the federal government and the USDA. And he made sure that Nebraska got first crack at this. And he traveled a lot through the country explaining this amino assay method. I don't know whether Nebraska supplied immune serum to other states or not, but I doubt it. I think probably what he would do is to get the other states to use the Nebraska model, where the state would grow the rabbits and harvest the serum, mm-hmm. purify the antibodies, mm-hmm. and then distribute it to the antibodies to these potato associations. And he did an awful lot of, trained all of the offices of all the potato associations in Nebraska to use this, and trained a lot of other states on how to train the local growers. So that was the, talk about the Green Revolution, this is the White Revolution.
Yes. Must have made him a very noted figure in the, the community, both in plant pathology and in the potato.
That was a remarkable achievement. Well, let's see.
Will you just follow out your father's life and
I'm going to.
Please.
Very soon, I'm going to get very sketchy, and then I'll get back to some more of his interactions with me, which will fill things out more. He resigned the department headship to change to full-time research in 66. And in 67, he went to Columbia. 68, he resigned UNL, which amazed me, and really early retirement, became ESCO's first application chemist. And he wound up finally as the head of a small group here. In 1975, in May, he contracted cancer. My mother died the same year. He was married in 1976, in March, but died in September of 76. Okay, my mother, Norma Peterson Ellington, was born in 1912 in Holdridge, which is a Swedish enclave in central Nebraska. She lived with her parents out farm outside Holdridge. Only learned how to speak English when she was in the first grade in school in 1918. Entered UNL in 29, an honor student in home economics. Member of various honor societies and graduated in 33. Taught high school for 1 year. Met my father in about 1931 and married in 1933. After this time, her life converged on her husband, my father. Called the 1950s typical housewife mother. She was psychologically dependent on my father. She had outside interests, including her old family, especially that with a lot of old Swedes that were fun to talk to once you had learned how to learn to talk to somebody that spoke with a really thick Swedish accent. In fact, really one thing, we go out there often to go fishing or pheasant hunting or something like that before I had polio. And after I had polio, I went out there for somebody's wedding. I don't remember who it was, a lot of them. And but after the wedding, her uncle Vic, came up to me and he said,
"Well, Bobby, how do you like the wedding?"
And like that, I can't do that very well. You really have to hear the real thing. And I says, "Oh, I had a pretty good Uncle Rick." And he says, "Well, I just assumed you were to a dog fight." Very bluntly. The Swedes are like the Dutch. They don't fool around. See what they think. That was Uncle Rick and Aunt Selma. I have lots of memories of them. Aunt Selma lived into the middle 80s. And visited Lincoln, my wife and I, Lincoln, a couple times before she died. Let's see. Getting back on another, in addition to her old family, which also included her mother, who stayed with us quite a bit of the time when I was a kid. Relatives, other relatives, UNL, Womack Department, friends, classmates, college societies. And the shock of my father's diagnosis of terminal cancer aggravated her existing heart problem. She died about a week later. Just bang, bang, like that. Mm-hmm. It was just terrible. Mm-hmm. And I was born in September 35 in Madison, Wisconsin. We lived in an approximately 1910 rented bungalow on Crandall Street. Moved in 38 to a new home at 236 East Sunset Court on the edge of the town. Moved in 48 to 908 West Charles, a rented house in Champaign, Illinois. Moved in again in 48 after several months to a purchased house at 406 South Edmund Street. I have more vivid recollections of my life before age 3 than most persons have. Two memories were before I could either walk or talk. One was routine and couldn't be verified, but I have good verification of the other. My father bought a new Ford, 1936 Ford, in May 1936. I remember the season. I was about 8 months old, and he perched me on a fender, straddling the stalk of a stalk mine and headlight. I remember hanging on to the headlight and hearing my father and some neighbors laugh at me holding on so I didn't fall off. And I noticed the fender was warm, and I looked down and I saw my white diapers contrasting with the maroon of the car. And I looked up and saw my father taking my picture. In 1979, my wife and I were examining old stuff that had been saved for a long time. We found two rolls of exposed but undeveloped film. Had been processed and printed. One contained the baby pictures of the 96 Ford and its head, 36 Ford and its head.
How about that?
Yeah. Yeah. For years, people have told me I was crazy.
Good, see?
except for a penchant for exploring storm sewers, my activities as a young child were not particularly unusual. Found participation with other kids in World War II adventures. We were all Americans. Nobody wanted to be Japanese or Germans. More involvement after age 6 in home workshop and taking things apart and sometimes getting them together again. For example, the time my father bought me a wind-up alarm clock in 1943, I didn't get it apart, of course, and without damaging it. And I would have been able to get it together, except I wasn't strong enough to wind the springs up to get them reset. And so I gave up on that. And I had a lot of fun playing with batteries and lamps and doorbells and stuff. And my father gave me a chemistry set at age 8, and gave my brother and I an erector set when I was 9. My first electronic contact with electronics was at a Cub Scout meeting when I was 9. The program was on a crystal set made by a local radio repairman, and I acquired plans on how to make a very simple crystal set, and my father helped me build it. Amazingly, it worked and picked up 2 stations. We even built the crystal detector. And I don't remember where we found the crystal. I do remember it was a lead sulfide, cubic lead sulfide crystal. Then followed a long dry period in which I attempted to make more complex radios. I failed every time until I was 13. Wrong kind of tube, bad batteries, bad home link coils. So forth. My father was pretty disgusted about this. He was really disappointed. So was I, but he let me know that he thought I was can't you make a radio yet? You know, and one of them I had I remember one of them where I blew it because I saw the article later. They had used 2 tubes to run it